Welcome to the Legally Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, Rob Hanna. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Florence Blocklesbury. Florence is the founder of Bellevue Law and is a solicitor with expertise in litigation, dispute resolution, and employment law. Florence studied at the University of Oxford before completing her LPC and postgraduate diploma in international law at the University of Bristol. Florence then joined Freshfields as a trainee and qualified as a solicitor in 2000. She worked at the firm's London, Brussels, and Hong Kong offices. In 2006, Florence moved to US law firm Debevoise & Plimpton before starting her role as a law lecturer at BPP Law School. In 2014, Florence founded Bellevue Law, a boutique law firm specializing in employment law, legal disputes, regulatory investigations, compliance, and private client work. Florence is passionate about pro bono work, with experience serving as a trustee of the Royal Courts of Justice, Citizens Advice Bureau, and South West London Law Centres. So, a very big warm welcome, Florence.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Super excited about this one. And before we dive into all your amazing projects experience to date, we do have, as you know, I believe, a customary icebreaker question here on the Legally Speaking podcast, which is, on the scale of 1 to 10, 10 being very real, what would you rate the hit TV series Suits in terms of its reality of the law if you've seen it?
I have seen it and I would rate it a 2. Sadly, if only. I'm much more of a fan of the 90s show This Life, was about lawyers, Generation X lawyers like me, starting out their legal careers in London in the 90s. Unfortunately, that also wasn't a 10. My life as a trainee solicitor was much less exciting than the lives of the characters in This Life, but it was still more realistic, I think, than Suits, and I would recommend anybody who hasn't seen it to give it a watch.
There we go, and there's a strong recommendation. Well, talking of careers and training and journeys, I guess we should dive into yours, Florence. So would you mind telling our listeners a bit about your background and your career journey motivations?
Yes, it's been quite circuitous is probably the best way of describing it. I didn't study law at university. I did what was then called the law conversion course. And then after that, I started my legal career in a relatively traditional way. I trained at Freshfields in the late 90s. It wasn't like This Life. And there are lots of really positive things. I was there for about 8 years in total. And lots of really positive things that I got from that experience. Really high standards of technical advice and client service. Work ethic is one way of putting it. We worked really hard. And I know there's a big debate in the legal profession now about working hours. Obviously, there have to be some boundaries about that. But actually, within those boundaries, work ethic is really important. I travelled. I went to Brussels for 6 months as a trainee, and I went to Hong Kong for a couple of years when I was relatively junior. And I've got really enduring lifelong friendships from the people I worked with. In fact, my husband was in my trainee intake, so really lifelong enduring friendships. Aww. But also like a really wide variety of people who I still spend a lot of time with, still work with, still see socially. So it was really great. But I probably knew from very early on that I didn't really have any ambition to be a partner in a large firm. I was always interested in, I really enjoyed working in law. I really enjoy serving clients, but I probably didn't have the nature to spend a long career in a really large organization. I think I knew that from the start. When I was about 3 years qualified, I became the first head of pro bono at Freshfields, and I did pro bono work at Freshfields and Debevoise in Plimpton, the US firm in London, for about 5 years in total before I had my kids.
There we go. And look at that. There's a lot in there, because you did some tremendous work with Freshfields. There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask. Overall, sort of, you know, people who are thinking about maybe applying to the Magic Circle US firms, what would be sort of, you know, two key reasons you would say, actually, you know what, it's definitely worth going to the Magic Circle? And then also your areas of expertise, you've got experience across sort of litigation disputes, employment law. What specifically drew you to those areas of law?
Those are really good questions. So My experience of applying for training contracts and becoming a trainee is ancient history.
Not quite, but I get the point.
I started my training contract in 1998, and I think it's a lot harder now than it was then to get start work. I hope and believe that the SQE is going to make a real difference to accessibility to the legal profession. But I think it's, you know, I don't feel that I'm in any way qualified to advise anyone about how to go about getting a training contract, because I have to say, I feel like it's so much easier then than it is now. If it's any consolation, we all got paid a lot less than they get paid now. was the trade-off, but I would say that in my own experience of it was very, very positive in lots of ways, and it was a very good grounding in legal practice generally. I now work in a firm which is much, much smaller. There are 20 lawyers, there are 25 people in the firm altogether. So it's the complete opposite end of the spectrum. And that meant that I've had to make, I've had to learn quite a lot of stuff for myself about running a much smaller firm and the dynamic there. But I would still recommend that, you know, if anybody has the interest in commercial law and the opportunity, you know, to work in one of these large firms, there are lots of advantages to it. But it's not the only, you know, it's not the only path to a successful legal career. And I think there are lots of opportunities to work differently and gain experience, which is just different but equally valuable as well.
Yeah, no, I think really well said. One thing you talked about was your pro bono roles, and that might be less familiar to some of our listeners. So would you mind telling us a bit about your pro bono manager role at Debevoise and what that sort of entailed?
Yeah, so I was just, you know, one of the things that working in large firms does is it does give you a lot of opportunities if you're willing to take them. And I had always been interested in human rights law. When I qualified, I used my sabbatical to go and spend some time working in Texas on death row cases. And I've always had this interest alongside, you know, obviously working in a really large firm on large commercial cases. The Human Rights Act came into force while I was training. And so it was quite an area of interest even for commercial clients at the time. So when the opportunity came up, Fresh Fields created its first pro bono lawyer role. I jumped at the chance, actually. I'd been in Hong Kong for a couple of years and I came back. And it was extremely unstrategic, actually, as have many things been in my career. But first of all, it was just a wonderful opportunity to get involved in doing some really special, worthwhile work. Back in the early 2000s, there was much less tradition for lawyers to do pro bono work in the UK than there was in the US, because we'd always had a legal aid system. And I think that that's probably been dismantled now to the point that it's very widely recognised that as a profession, those of us who can do something to support people who need our particular skills ought to be doing it. And it can't just be left to legal aid lawyers to help the most vulnerable people in society, because there just isn't the funding or the capacity to do that. But about 20 years ago or so, it was more of a novel idea. And so I was the first pro bono lawyer at Freshfields, and then moved to Debevoise, which was an American firm. And those firms have, you know, very long-standing commitment to doing really excellent pro bono work. And we worked across a range of pro bono matters, from advising small organisations, advising charities on their sort of corporate structures and the way that they ought to organise and run themselves, to providing employment law representation for litigants in person in employment tribunals, to really large human rights projects such as supporting lawyers working on death row cases in the Caribbean and in the States, and actually in the early 2000s, working on some of the human rights issues that came out of the war on terror as well.
Wow, it sounds like a fascinating role and some really meaningful work that you did there. And talking of meaningful work and your career, we have to talk about 2014, where you founded Bellevue Law, which is a boutique law firm specializing in employment law, legal disputes, regulatory investigations, compliance and private client work. Would you mind firstly telling our listeners why you set up the firm and perhaps why flexible working is important to you?
Yes, of course. So I'd been working in these large firms in the city, and albeit doing quite an unusual role. I had children in my 30s, and I had three children really close together. At one point, I had three preschoolers, and I just didn't want to go. It was I should have gone back for a rest, actually, but I just didn't really want to go back, you know, at the time, you know, being in the office and long hours. I know a lot of people who have made that work, and, you know, more power to them, but that just wasn't what I wanted to do. I had a period of about 5 years where I taught at law school, and that was a really great job to do for a while, but I knew I wanted to be in practice. And I looked around to see the job that would allow me to do really good quality work, interesting work for clients, but at the same time be around for my small children. I just couldn't find it. I think things have changed a lot in the intervening decade. I hope they have, but I just couldn't find it. And so I just had this idea, which was a bit mad at the time. I'm going to just set up my own law firm and I'm going to work the way that I want to work. And I had no clients. I'd not been in practice for 5 years, but I had a bit of self-belief. And I'm also, I think this is really important for anyone who's thinking about striking out on their own, I'm also not scared of failing. What's the worst thing that can happen is that it's a bit embarrassing. You know, I've told everybody I'm going to set up this law firm, and then if I have to shut the doors after 6 months, 12 months, it will be a bit embarrassing, but life will go on. So I set up the firm on a shoestring, really. Had a website, had a laptop, had some professional indemnity insurance, had an email address. And I just told everybody I knew, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to set up a firm doing employment law and litigation. If anybody needs support in that, please let me know. And slowly, slowly, I started to pick up clients from quite a wide range of sources, ranging from referrals from city firms where they had slightly lower value disputes that they wouldn't be able to handle themselves cost effectively. They just wanted a safe pair of hands. Three of my clients were on the school run. I was just chatting to other mums in the playground, and I wasn't doing BD. I was just dropping my kids at school, and they all had employment law issues at work, and I was able to help them with it. And gradually the business grew. I needed to hire. And I realized very early on that there's a really huge pool of talent. At first, it was really other mothers who'd been working in city law firms, didn't want to do those hours, didn't want to be in the office 5 days a week, still wanted to work, work hard, do good quality work. And I was able to hire just the most exceptional lawyers with these, you know, absolutely stellar backgrounds just by offering them flexibility. They then did a great job for clients. And the clients came back. And so we continued to grow. And we've now got a pool of 20 lawyers, a really mixed bag of backgrounds, interests, practice areas. But really, I think the thread that joins us all together is an interest in autonomy and flexible working alongside doing really good quality work and a commitment to really high ethical standards, which means it's a delight to work with everybody in the firm.
Yeah, and you've done such a tremendous job. That there's so much wisdom you shared there and so many learns. And just my own entrepreneurial journey, listening back to that, you know, you basically said, you know, your story is if you can't find it, build it, which you went out and did. And, you know, what a success story that is. But also talked a lot about fear. I see so many people that are held back because of fear. You know, it's a big face everything and rise. I strongly believe that, you know, it's very easy, you know, 5 years out to then sort of perhaps, you know, keep looking, try and find something, can maybe have to compromise. But you said, no, actually, it doesn't matter. I believe in this. I'm passionate about this. I want to go out there and do it. And I love it. And then just some natural networking case studies there of, you know, people that are already in your immediate network that you can pick up some employment law cases. And, you know, they always say, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything. And that's so true. And, you know, I really enjoyed learning your story. I set up a legal recruitment business without a day's legal recruitment experience under my belt or not knowing hardly anyone in the legal industry. But you can still do it if you've got the skills, tools to make it happen. You were still a very good lawyer, and then you've picked up and grown along the way. So absolutely love that. That's the positive part. Let's get to the also slightly harder, more let's get in the real, let's get in the trenches part, because it's not a walk in the park success, but it's definitely worth it. What have been some of the challenges you faced in establishing Bellevue Law, and how have you managed to overcome them?
That's such a great question. There have been loads of challenges. I think the first one, which I've already alluded to, is so my background was working in really large firms and being quite a small cog in a very large wheel. And when you're in a firm, you're suddenly responsible for absolutely everything. And I had no experience whatsoever of managing a law firm. And, you know, instead of being responsible for servicing my clients and looking after them and doing a good job for them, I still had to do that. But alongside that, I then had to do all of the business development, all of clients, all of the IT, which is not a strength for me, all of the finance, had to buy professional indemnity insurance. And now I'm 10 years in now, and I'd say for the last 5 years, I've been really comfortable that there's always a way. You know, you can always find a solution to any kind of problem. And the more we've grown, the more resources I've had, fortunately, you know, to be able to bring in people to support me in the business and also to outsource the things that I don't either enjoy or do as well as I might do, and allow me to focus on the things that I want to do. But from day one, I really had to just sort of roll my sleeves up and get on with it. That was definitely a challenge and a learning curve. I think for people now setting up law firms, there are a lot more materials and resources to help you. I had a book that I bought from the Law Society that was really outdated talked about sort of setting up a fax machine in your home office, but was still helpful in terms of some of the sort of compliance and regulatory bits and pieces that I just wasn't really sufficiently familiar with. I think the other thing that's changed in the last 10 years is that there are now really wonderful supportive networks of other people who are on a similar journey, genuinely wanting to support each other. I regularly speak to other people who are thinking about setting up legal businesses, and I regularly talk to other founders about the challenges, sort of slightly niche and nerdy challenges that nobody else would know about or want to know about. And there's a really lovely, friendly, supportive community of people who want to help each other, which is wonderful.
Yeah, no, and I absolutely support that. And we have shared values around that, particularly around the importance of community. And look, Bellevue Law is a huge success story. But as you've sort of alluded to, there are challenges. So if you were to sort of, you know, inspire the next legal leader to set up maybe a law firm, a legal technology practice, whatever it might be, what words of wisdom do you wish you had known before founding your own business?
So, well, I was given these words of wisdom before I started my own business. And I didn't really take much notice of them, but I hammer them into anybody I speak to. I knew one person who'd set up his own law firm before I set up mine, and I spoke to him. He very kindly gave me some time and talked to me about his own experience. He said, "You are worried now about where you're going to get work from, and I'm just going to tell you now that your real worry will be that you'll have too much work and how you manage it." And what he was really saying to me was, why would you not be a success? You know, we're not selling snake oil. We advise people on areas of their life where they need advice. So we advise on employment law, we advise on disputes, we advise on wills and probate, and we advise on regulation. There's a genuine need for that advice. We are good at it. Lots of other people are good at it too, but you know, we are good at what we do, and we treat them well and we charge them fairly. Why would they not use us? And the same applies to lots of other firms. We're not particularly unique in that regard, but we're not selling snake oil and we're not marketing something that we don't do. Why would you not be successful? And that being the case, build the firm for the growth. I spent a lot of time in the first instance, sort of, I built a really tiny firm that was based around just me in basically a posh shed that I've got in the garden back there. And now we're much larger. I regret not having put in place the infrastructure sooner to allow us to grow and to lean into that. And I regret slightly not, sort of being brave enough to invest more than I did. And I regularly say to people, just assume you're going to succeed. Of course you have to plan, and of course you have to be conservative in your planning. But I think lawyers are naturally extremely nervous, anxious people. And the reality is that, you know, you're going out there and doing great work. Why would it not be successful? I would really say, believe in yourself and be very focused on what you want to do, and move forwards with it. And there's no reason at all why it won't be successful.
And again, I couldn't believe, you know, what you're saying, because so many people always look at what if it goes wrong, you know, what if it goes right? You know, there need to be around more people with the growth mindset. And, you know, obviously you had some great words of wisdom for starting. I strongly believe if you have the right people who have that growth mindset around you, you're going to be in a far better place than others, because you're just consuming the ability to take and absorb risk, but also manage that risk and actually take action. Where a lot of people think, oh, well, what if I lose clients, or what if my fees are too high, or what if I can't afford it for the first 3 months, or this, what if, what if, what if? But what about that what is mentality? You know, what is it actually take action? So I love that, and I love the story, I love the journey. Time for a short break from the show. Are you trapped in a relationship with the wrong legal software provider? It's time to break free and switch to Clio. For a limited time, when you switch to Clio, you can get up to 6 months off a Clio subscription, a free data migration scoping call, and a £100 gift card for attending a demo. Clio is your cost-effective and flexible solution. Choose a plan that fits your needs and budget with no long-term commitments. Pricing starts from just £49 per user per month. Worried about the migration process? Don't be. Clio handles the migration of your existing data and ensures a smooth transition with zero downtime. Join the thousands of solicitors who trust Clio. Switch to Clio now and save. Visit clio.com/UK/breakfree to learn more. This is a limited time offer. Terms and conditions apply. Now back to the show. Talk us through a day to day. So again, you shared a really important point where, you know, a lot of people may go on to set up a business, but in reality, what they actually do is buy themselves a job where they're overpaid, overworked, and actually they're not actually as sort of fulfilled as they might want to be because they didn't set up the processes, the infrastructure, allow for growth, assuming you want that type of business. So for you, you know, I guess my first question is, could your business operate without you for a week, a month? And what does a typical day look like?
I suspect my business could operate without me for quite a long time, but I am too much of a control freak to let it do so. and that does need to change. I mean, I've been doing it now for 10 years. And I, if I'm really honest, I set up the business to have better work-life balance. And yep. I'm not sure how good my work-life balance has been throughout it. I've had a lot more flexibility and a lot more control, but I have still worked really hard. And I'm broadly speaking, I'm a believer that nothing worth having comes too easy. You do have to be prepared to graft a little bit. It's been priceless to me to have the flexibility that I've had along the way. And now I occasionally talk to people who are setting up law firms and they're really boundaried. I know people who've got 4-day weeks, they're really boundaried about it and they do make it work. So they've probably just got a better mentality around that than I have, but I'm moving towards being able to do that. And I think, ironically, as we've grown, I've been able to step away a bit more because I've got some brilliant people in the business. I've got a brilliant team of lawyers. We hired our first chief operating officer at the end of last year, and that's been a game changer for me because she's just absolutely wonderful and she does a lot of things better than I was doing them before, but also frees me up to do other things that I want to do, like talking to you, Rob. I think it's really hard because the work will expand to fill the time available and you need to be really careful. I would say at the beginning you need to define what success looks like, and you know that could be that it looks like really rapid growth and you're prepared to throw yourself into it 24/7, or it could be that you chose to do this for work-life balance and actually that means you have to say no to something and say no to some opportunities and be, you know, sort of clear about what you will and won't do. It's going to look different for different people. But it's best probably every so often just check in with yourself. Are you achieving success in your own eyes yet? And if not, what needs to change to get you there?
And yeah, really well said, because, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. You may have set up your firm and you may have X number of people and someone may have double that, or, you know, more revenue or whatever it may be, or better clients in your opinion. But, you know, what does that success look like to you? You know, is it maybe that you want to be able to put your son or your daughter to bed every night and, you know, have that time to read the story that you may not necessarily get back? Or is it you want to go to get those extra pounds into your business bank account? I think it's so true that you say run your own race at your own pace and sort of be really set on what's important to you, because I see a lot of people that are in careers or running businesses and they're almost at the end of steam because they forget what's important, what success looks like for them, because they're continuously comparing. And I think we can get as a whole discussion around social media and how that has sort of for good and for bad, but just you share a really important point there. Really think about what's important to you and check in on yourself, because I have a slightly different view, and I just picked this off of listening to a podcast myself. I don't believe in work-life balance. There's just life, i.e. for me, life just happens. And so I set up my business for similar reasons for you, needing that flexibility. But sometimes I may find it easier to send an email for half an hour on a Saturday. And for me, that's absolutely fine. But then I can take that hour off on a Wednesday to go and play golf, whatever it might be. So, you know, for me, it's about that just overarching flexibility. Or if, you know, I've had a poorly daughter, I need to go do this. So really like that you kind of touched on a lot of good points there, and really hopefully have inspired other people to take the opportunity, not the risk, to set up their own business and go on and be a success. But let's talk about business models, because you have a slightly different business model to what's quasi-known traditional law firms. So talk us through your business model and why you chose to use that one for Bellevue Law.
So we're a consultancy firm. We've 20 lawyers in the firm, and they are mostly very senior. Well, they're all very senior. They're partner level lawyers, and they're self-employed, and we operate a fee share model. And the advantage of that for the lawyers is that they'll get paid more per hour than they would get paid in a traditional model. But also, we don't set any chargeable targets, so people can manage their own workload. We hope people come to work, and they do, but we don't have any minimum requirements for how much work they do. We don't even really monitor it in a very meaningful way. Sometimes the lawyers will get in touch with me and they'll say, "I'm sorry, I've been quiet this month," and I haven't noticed, because that's not what I'm looking for. You know, obviously, overall, people have to go to work, otherwise we won't have a business. But these are people who are dedicated professionals, and I just give them the flexibility. We have one rule, which is that if you commit to do something for a client, you have to do it. But we regularly turn away work rather than overload the team. And we allow the team the flexibility to work exactly where and exactly when they want to work. And the advantage of that for me is, A, it sort of chimes with the way that I want to work myself, but B, it's been fundamental to my ability to hire really world-class lawyers into, you know, a firm that I started in my garden shed. It's slightly different now. We can't all fit in the shed. But it's meant that although I'm a very, very small firm, I've got this sort of really international caliber of lawyer working with us, and it is because we offer that flexibility. So it's not something that we offer as a nice to have or as window dressing. It is the very heart of the business, and it's at the core of the business's success. So it's very, very fundamental to us.
Yeah, and again, a great point. You know, back to your point about why would your business not be success, the services that you're offering. When you agitate the pain point that much that people are going to want to buy, i.e., you know, if people are in an issue with employment or in their dispute, they need to instruct a high quality lawyer typically to get out of that. You know, similarly, if people are really struggling to find flexible working and they just can't find anywhere that they want to maintain that practice, you know, you've agitated that pain point to provide a good solution, a great home for people to continue their careers and flourish. So I really like that. And you're on talk of growth, you know, you're always looking to grow the firm, and you've given some great examples of how you've gone from the shed to your current set of numbers, which is super impressive. How do you go about the recruitment process? And if people may be listening to this or in the areas that you're interested in, you know, how could they maybe get in touch to apply?
Oh yeah, we're hiring. So please do get in touch. We're very small, and we have tended to recruit quite organically. That might change as we grow. I'm not planning to build an enormous empire. And as you said, you know, you define your own success. I know people who've built firms much faster than I have, and I've built it alongside sort of a number of challenges that I've had in my family and my personal life. And I've been extremely grateful to work in the kind of job that I do, where I've had the flexibility to be able to deal with some family health issues alongside continuing to grow the business. But I haven't seen it as sort of the equivalent of some kind of fast growth tech business. We've grown because the work has grown and great lawyers have wanted to join us, and it's been relatively organic. We probably would look to continue to grow in that way as long as there is the work to do and lawyers who want to join us. But I think that the really exciting thing right now in law is that there just are so many different opportunities. So we do offer something different from some other firms, that I can think of 10 other places that offer something different again from what we do, and the right home for the right lawyer will be, you know, different in each individual case. But I think maybe when I started out, when I was newly qualified, there was a sense that there was only one way to have a successful career in law, and that was probably to, you know, sort of work your way up to partnership in an established law firm. And that's still a great career path for the people that's a great career path for, but there are a lot of other people for whom something different is going to be more suitable, whether that's, you know, an in-house career, working in a really exciting alternative legal service provider, or working in this kind of model, in the consultancy model. Not just us, but, you know, lots of consultancy firms have sort of grown. And I think my experience is that since COVID, people have taken it an awful lot more seriously, the idea that you could work remotely. And we have an office, but we're very hybrid, so, you know, people can work from, we've got lawyers all over the country, so they can just work from home as much as they want to. And clients as well are much more accepting of it, because no matter which firm, you know, the most enormous international firms were still talking to their clients on Teams throughout the pandemic. And so everybody is much more understanding now of that slightly different way of working. I think it's not really a challenger position anymore. Whereas when I set it up 10 years ago, it was a little bit more unusual.
Yeah, no, but, you know, pioneer, you know, it's great that, you know, you've been early to something and, you know, you've gone on and you've had tremendous success. Want to talk about the dynamic nature of where we find ourselves within the legal industry, because things are changing. You know, I can't finish a podcast without talking about AI and tech, of course. But, you know, how do you ensure Bellevue Law stays at the forefront of emerging trends in employment law and dispute resolution?
So from, talking about AI and tech, I would say I'm very deliberately not staying at the forefront of that. That's just not what we do. That I set up the firm 10 years ago and technology enabled me to do that. And we use technology where the solutions work for us and for the clients, but we will probably not be early adopters of almost anything because it's just not necessary for the nature of our practice. I find it really interesting watching other people and what they can do with tech, and there are aspects of it that, of course, you know, we will incorporate. We try to be a little bit ahead of the curve is in thinking about the intersection between employment law and culture, and then in particular in the legal profession itself. Quite a significant proportion of my own clients are lawyers who are not happy at work. And I always have to remind myself that the happy ones don't phone me. So I just see this sort of, the picture that I see is not necessarily fully representative of the profession, but it's very clear from the work I do and from talking to other people working in law that there are a lot of very systemic cultural issues in law generally, whether that's about sexual misconduct, whether that's about the treatment of working mothers, whether that's about diversity more generally across a range of protected characteristics and also I think maybe sort of social mobility. And the legal profession is naturally very conservative, and it doesn't necessarily suit the people who have the most power within it to change. And that's been a struggle, I think, in the legal industry quite a long time. I'm hopeful and positive that there will be quite a lot of change over the next 10 years, that we'll see real change. We'll see larger firms recognising the benefits to them of making some quite tough decisions in order to become more diverse and inclusive places, but also technology and culture enabling people who are not happy to pursue promising careers in other aspects, maybe vote with their feet. And as I said, I'm really privileged to be part of a group of people who do have a slightly different approach to law and legal business. And it's just a really exciting time from that point of view. And I think I would encourage anyone who is thinking about a career in law or who's already working in law and not happy to take ownership of that and to think about what they want to do and to find a path to doing it, because it absolutely is possible if you can find it in yourself to be a little bit brave and potentially take a small amount of a chance. And because I'm an employment lawyer, I do see that the status quo is also taking a chance. You know, if you stay employed somewhere, you're not happy, there's a risk associated with that. Plenty of people lose their jobs and plenty of people really suffer in a work environment that doesn't suit them. And there's also a risk associated with doing something different, but you only have one life and you probably should do the thing that is going to bring you some joy and satisfaction.
Yeah, I love that you talk about self-accountability. You know, sometimes, is it tough love? I'm not sure. You know, I just remember one of my mentors said to me, you know, if it's meant to be, it's up to me. And it's so true. You know, sometimes you need to put yourself and actually take the action. You know, everyone can complain about something, right? Everyone can sort of have, some sort of thing going on. But if you can kind of take self-accountability to say, do you know, I want to put myself in a better environment, I want to do this, you know, it's so, so much beneficial that in the long run, saying, I should have done. And you talked about this, but I just want to sort of maybe get maybe one or two practical tips, because, you know, you mentioned you regularly act for senior professional, you know, women defending their workplace rights, including gender, maternity, discrimination claims, and so forth. You know, how can workplaces create a more supportive and empowering workplace environments, or what are sort of one or two easy tips for firms to implement right from the start?
I don't know if it's easy or not, but it's very clear that it just has to come from the top. And there is very little point to having a diversity task force, 25 different amazing policies, lovely photos of a diverse workforce on the website, if from the top there isn't that fundamental commitment to it. You either have it or you don't have it. And everything flows from that. I think that's, you know, there are cultures within firms, you know, so there'll be one department that might be, have a different culture to another department. But fundamentally, it is about leadership and fairness. And if you have that, it's really easy. And if you don't have it, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, I love that. You know, the actions will ultimately always speak louder than the words. And actually, if you put all these things on the website and it doesn't happen, then it creates even more of a negative effect because it's sort of, you know, not actually what's being preached. You mentioned earlier on some of your other roles, and I want to briefly touch on them before we look to close. You know, you've served as a trustee of the Royal Courts of Justice Citizens Advice Bureau and South West London Law Centres. You've also represented clients facing the death penalty in the Caribbean and the US, as you touched on. How did you personally navigate those extremely emotional complexities of such cases?
That's a really good question. And I think most lawyers would say that they are able to do the things that they really strongly believe in and they think are important, but to just keep one step removed from it to maintain objectivity and fairness. And there was a couple of things that I did that I found very, very challenging indeed. But I do, and I still deal with people who are very vulnerable and very distressed on a regular basis. It's just part of the nature of our work. And I hope that we would always treat our clients with real empathy and kindness, not just to see it as a process, a legal process, to be giving them legal advice, but to be providing quite a human approach and an empathetic approach. Yeah. At the same time, you can't do the job if you become emotionally too entangled in it. You need to be able to just keep that step back so that you remain objective and you're providing advice that is objective. I think I learned that at a really early age, and I think it's stood me in good stead, and it allows me to look after myself while I'm doing that kind of work at the same time. So I think it's something that most lawyers who do this kind of work would have in common, not to be detached, but at the same time to, you know, just have that little bit of space that allows you to recognize that your role here is as an advisor. It's not to become personally involved in it.
Yeah, no, really well said. I think that's some critical advice. And before we let you go, finally, what advice do you have for aspiring lawyers looking to specialise in, be it litigation or employment law, and equally maybe professionals that are thinking of setting up a business but haven't quite done it yet?
The second one. If you're thinking of setting a business and you haven't done it yet, you have to ask yourself what's holding yourself back. Write a plan. Don't wait for it to be perfect. Go for it. I think for people starting out in law now, you probably don't want to take advice from someone who's 50, to be honest, because my world was so different when I was starting out. But if I had my thoughts on it are that the industry's changed a lot in the last few years. It's going to change enormously out of all recognition, and so you need to have a sense of what your career might look like is probably going to be quite different from what my career looked like. And that being said, so it's just difficult to plan too far. I think you need to be flexible, you need to be adaptable, you need to practice being resilient, which is a really important skill in any career. And then I would say go and get as much experience as you can doing everything and anything, because you just never know what will be the thing that lights a spark for you, and you never know where law is going to take you. But it gives you, as a profession, it will give you so many opportunities if you're open to them. And I would be really optimistic about what the legal career of somebody starting out now, what that might look like. It could be fun, exciting, and purposeful.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you talked about sort of opportunities and being open to them. I would just encourage people to Google the red car theory. I did a post about this on LinkedIn recently, but if you go and have a little research into that, it's all about sort of being alive to opportunities and keeping that open mind. This has been an absolute blast, Florence, as I knew it would have been, and that's why I was super keen to get you on the show. If our listeners want to learn more about Bellevue Law, or indeed they would like to get in touch about applying, where can they find out more? Feel free to shout out any website links and any social media handles, and we'll also share them with this episode for you too.
Thank you. Part of the success of our firm has been from the people who we've met on social media as well as in real life. So we're delighted to hear from anyone who's interested in the firm. Our website is bellevuelaw.co.uk. We're also on LinkedIn, and I'm on LinkedIn as well, at Florence Brocklesby.
Simple as that. Well, thank you so much, Florence. As I say, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. Wishing you lots of continued success with Bellevue Law, your future career and pursuits. But for now, from all of us on the Leaders Speaking podcast, over and out. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you like the content here, why not check out our world-leading content and collaboration hub, the Legally Speaking Club, over on Discord. Go to our website, www.legallyspeakingpodcast.com, for the link to join our community there. Over and out.